Accession number 11377, reel 20.
Mr. W. Bateman, reel 20. How were you received at the 9th Battalion, Mr. Bateman?
Well, we were here quite welcome, because when they got to know we'd come from the Middle East, and he says, "All right, these are the lads we want." So they built us this with A Company when we got there till next day, and then we went on parade, and then we met this sergeant, an old pal of ours out of the signal platoon in India called Story, and he was, we didn't know at the time that he was a carrier sergeant, and he says, "Oh," he says, "I think I'll get you with me." I said, "Boy, well, don't mind, like." So he said, "Right, all right." So when the officer come out to say where we're going, he said, "Right, so it's you, George Sparrow, and Bateman." He said, "Go with Sergeant Story." So right, all right. So picked our kit, went along, like. And we says, "What company are you?" He says, "I'm in the carrier patrol." Oh, he says, so Geordie's Sparrow's eyes lit up. He says, "Oh," he says, "do you want a donna or a dispatch rider?" He says, "Oh, yes." He says, "You can do a dispatch rider." So we settled in with the carrier platoon. They hadn't the carriers then, like, and they had no motorbikes. So they settled in there, and I don't recognise how long we were there.
How were you received with men who were not professional soldiers?
Oh yes, they were quite good pals. There was a lot not Durham, from the Durham. There was one from Birmingham, there was one from Derby. Poor lad was killed, him from Birmingham. And there was a lad from Coventry in the platoon. And then there was another lad from Beedale, I think. Forget his name now. And so mainly we got to know each carrier, put us into a carrier crew. See, there was a full corporal, there was a driver, there was a gunner, and an observer. See, there was four of us. And when Geordie got to be a dispatch rider, I went with, forgetting his name, this full corporal, he was from Birmingham. Then there was the driver was from Coventry, I think it was. And this was the lad from Beedy, I think. So we all got on quite well together, like. Yes. She was nice to settle them.
Had they seen action, the people?
Oh, yes, they'd been in the desert and Cyprus, Sicily. So we all settled down together, and that we did want to start to be trained, like. And they said, "We'll settle you." And I said, "Well, I've never been to carry before, like." So he says, "You get used to it." He says, "You get rocketed around a bit and tossed about a bit." So we did a bit training on
what,
the...
What kind of training was it that you'd taken?
It's more like making an attack. Because you didn't take the carriers, they just transported you to there, and you dismounted, and you did some fire like on an open range. And they had targets set out at different ranges, as if it was in any position. So we did that about two or three times over a week, like, and then that's when they got the carriers, because they're brand new carriers. They said, "Well, you hadn't to do them to, because just run them in." Then they decided that they wanted some carriers converting to flamethrowers, and they would have to pick the one I was with. So this is right, Oasis, you can be a flamethrower gunner, so we have to learn that.
How did the flamethrower work on the carrier itself? What was it?
Well, the carrier was, there was, at either side now, there was a compressed air cylinder, and there was a tank full of crude oil. And I don't know how it was connected up, like, I can't remember now, because we never connected it up. And there was also a small, a gallon can of petrol. And what happened, see, how it worked, these conjunctions, you turned the compressor, the compressed air, and it went into the tank, and also into the petrol. And when you pressed it all combined, and when you pressed the trigger, you need a spark. And it lit like a little slight flame, and it ignited. the petrol, and they ignited the petrol, ignited the oil, and it threw it for about nearly 50 yards, I should think. Because we practiced on a blockhouse. There was a blockhouse there, specially designed for it. Mm.
So this would stay with the car. You didn't take it off. You drive your carrier up.
Drive up and then fire it. Oh no, you couldn't, because I think it was about 500 gallons tank. Or a 50 gallon tank. I know. And I'd filled this one side of the carrier up, and we laid in the middle of it, between this. Mm.
What was your role? Were you driving it? Or?
No, I wasn't. No, I couldn't drive it. This lad from I think Coventry drove it. And this was me. This lad from BDL was the number two. He was on the back with us, because he used to carry on it. We carried all our gear, blankets, and everything, and equipment.
And was it your job to fire the?
Yes, he could fire it. Sure, the lad could fire it, and I could fire it at the same time. Mm. But he would check on the one that wasn't firing. Would check on the pressure, because you had pressure gauges on. And when the pressure went down, he would say, right, you haven't got any pressure, so because you had to just keep it in bursts. You didn't just keep it on all the time. Just keep it in bursts, and you'd see it throw, and all of a sudden it would ignite. Mm. It's like more like a delayed action. Mm. It didn't just ignite at the end of the gun. It used to move about maybe a couple of feet out by the time it got out. The pressure of the compressed air cylinder was to throw the oil straight out. Mm. But the first, before you really fire, you had to press it steady to get the pressure into the gun. I can't remember now, how long was it now? It'd be about 4 foot. It had a trigger on it, and it went out, and you put it into this like a nozzle for, and this gun was, he had it shoved it in a like a barrel, see? And it all connected up. I don't know how it was connected, like, but he says, right, or he says, all you have to do is just push it in there, and he says, you're all right, press it. So that's there, and then they sent us on leave. They sent us right, or he says, you can have a weekend's leave, see? He says, because you don't get any more for quite a while. So it was, I think it was on the Friday morning. No, this was on the Thursday, on the Friday morning.
What date was this?
Somewhere in May, I think it was. The back end of April, or the beginning of May, I can't remember now. It was either that time. They sent us off on the, he says, we don't need a pass, he says, you'll get a warrant if you can't afford to go home, like. He says, they're in the wrong distance. He says, we'll give you a warrant. So I got a warrant to Darlington. And the train, it took about nearly 10 hours, well, nearly 7 hours, to get from Southampton to King's Cross, to Wandlow Station. Then we had to go to King's Cross. It was early morning when we got into King's Cross, and we had to wait a while, and it was 6 o'clock in the morning when I got in. 6 o'clock on Saturday morning when we got to Darlington. So I had to go, he told us we'd be back by Tuesday morning, the valley Tuesday morning. No, it wasn't Tree Valley, it was 8 o'clock, he said. I said, I don't care, as long as you're back by 8 o'clock. So we decided how to get back on the, I said, I'll be all right, I'll set off back about 4 o'clock.
Were you tempted to stay?
No, I was never, all throughout my army career, I never attempted to deliberately go absent. I always kept on time. And there's one thing about it, that all the time I was there, I obeyed every order I got. I never disputed any order, I never argued with anybody. If I was told to do a thing, I did it. Because I was always told at home, never contradict your elders. My grandfather and grandmother said, never contradict your elders. And they told us that in the depot. They said, if you have a complaint, always take it, do it. And then complain after. if that's the best way. So I never attempted to, I said, Missy never said anything. She says, well, if you have to go, you have to go. Because my mate that I joined up with when we went to India, he was on the same draft as me, and he went absent. But he was on the next draft out. But he'd served 28 days detention before. So I get a train from Darlington to King's Cross.
Did your wife and yourself have any notion at this time that you may be going into action very quickly?
Oh yes, I knew, we knew we were going to go, but when, we didn't know, see.
Now how much did you tell your wife?
I just said we were preparing for the invasion, but I didn't tell her where we were, and I think I just said we're somewhere in the south of England, that's all.
How did she take it?
She said all right. She was all, because she'd been used to being away, see. She says, you went through the desert, so she says, you'll be all right. So, gets down and had to wait for the train at Liverpool. Listen, I would have Liverpool in my mind. Waterloo Station, we slept on the platform, and then there was, all of a sudden the porter shouted, there's a train for Southampton, so we got on the train to Southampton, and we arrived, I think it was somewhere about just 7 or 8 o'clock, and there's some trucks waiting for us to take us up to the camp.
Well, there are many men who didn't come back when they went on leave like this
I don't know, I can't remember. And then we went back, and then we decided to waterproof the carriers. So that was our more like routine every day.
How did you waterproof them?
Well, by sealing the engines. And
what did you use?
Some plastic, some like red oxide plastic. And put extensions on the carburettors. We put extensions on the more like the mechanics put the extension on, because they had to weld the
on the exhaust
and the stopping the carburettors for the breathe to come in. But we did round the plugs, and then the plug leads and the distributor all covered all everything in like. And then
did it prove to be very effective?
Well, I can't remember. Because I'll explain it. Now then, we did that, and then it says, right, oh, but the carriers weren't going to be driven, they were going to be transported down onto the ladder car, because she said that's all you can do now. And this was just before the invasion. So they said, right, oh, we're going down to practice a landing. So we went down to Eastbourne, and we sailed out in these little boats, and they just turned around and came back. They said, oh, that's what you'll do.
What boats were that you were being put on?
Just like little rowing boats. That's all, I can't remember now. And then when we came back, like, we got orders right here. It says, Bateman and Sparrow, you have to go to the signal platoon. You're not going with the carriers. Go. Well, I says, I thought they didn't want any signals. So we packed our kit from the carriers, and we went down into the second platoon.
How did they receive you?
Oh, this is, well, I tell the truth, I don't know how they received us. And I explained to the, this is all regular, the regular soldiers has come, he says, to show us what to do, he says, if we didn't know. But they're quite a good, set of good chaps, like, and, but they didn't believe what we'd done, see. They'd come from the desert with the 8th Army, and they forgot that we were the first lot in the desert. And they says, oh, they'd been to Malta. I says, ah, and I said, we went to Brook as well. Oh. And I said, we weren't in the one that packed up either. We were the one that held. So the type we got on the invasion.
Who was commanding the signal platoon?
Lieutenant Brooker. Procal Lieutenant Brooker.
Had anything changed with the equipment that you are now
having? Well, not exactly, but they had some radios. But I didn't ever radio then, because the other lads had them. I never got to have a radio again, because they kept me with their... He says, oh, we know what we'll do. Brooker says, we'll keep you as a lineman. See, I was a line signaller. Because I think they'd had the other lads training to be with the radios. And there were the 101 sets, I imagine, 101, or the, I forget now, it wasn't a 21 set, I think it was a 9 set. It was the one that, different to the one we had in the desert, it was one you could tune with a manual tune on your back. Hmm.
So your job was basically linesman?
Telephone line.
Repairing and maintaining the plane.
So we, then they confined us to barracks, to the tent, to the, this camp.
Do you call the name of the camp you were in?
Can you? So they confined us, and they said we weren't allowed out. And we knew that something was coming off then. So we got all lecture, we got a lecture, we all, the officers and that had been down to the Brigade HQ, and they got all the invasion rigmarole and everything, and they came back and explained us what we had to do and everything like.
Did you see maps or models of the area?
It just showed us a map. A map of the where we were going to land. It had no names on. No, just the eye. It was a good, when we eventually landed, it was a good substitute. And they said, you'll assembly, when you get off the boat, you'll assembly on this cornfield. Well, it hadn't been a cornfield, it was a vegetable field when we eventually got to it. So we got on trucks.
So you were confined to camp.
Oh, yes.
How did you feel about that?
Oh, we didn't feel, till we saw these American soldiers stuck up in the trees with these rifles and that. And that's when we did resented that.
So you were under guard, didn't you?
Yes, we were under guard, armed guard. We said, what we'd done. So we got on to the signal officer, and the sergeant got on to the signal officer, and everybody complained. The whole battalion, the lads, they. So this colonel, this Major Mogg, as far as I know, he got on to the brigade, and he told if he didn't get these American soldiers out of these trees and away from this camp, is as fast as possible, he says he'd turn his men on them. So eventually they all came round, but they still stopped in the area, but they weren't in the camp, they were outside the camp. Mm.
Who was commanding the battalion at this time?
Colonel Wood. I don't know his initial, because there was another Wood in the 8th Battalion, I think. So we were confined, I don't know how long we were confined to that, I think about 3 days. And then we said, right, oh, pack up your... You're going to pack up now, and you're going down onto the harbour. So we... It's got nice weather and all, so we got in these trucks and we went down to the harbour, and all these salt boats and everything, and we went onto these, some that had not were flaps at the front, they had ladders down the side, because we weren't going to the land, the invasion, the assault troops, they went on the front ones, I think it was the Green Howards, but we went on these one with ladders down the side. It was just the same. I think we were, I can't remember, I mean, I think we were there about 3 or 4 days. And we were just lounging round on the dockside, and playing bingo, playing cards.
You were allowed off the ship on the dockside?
On the dockside, yeah, because we were still in the docks, we hadn't sailed.
Did you see any important visitors that were...
No,
didn't. Seeing you off?
No, there's nobody there to see us off, nothing. Because it was all crowded. We never took any... We all were concerned about ourselves. We never bothered anybody. We didn't know. And
how are your feelings at this time? You knew you were going into an invasion situation.
We never thought about it. I said, there's only one thing I'm concerned about. I said, I don't lose my sight. I says, they can do anything with me, but I says, don't lose me sight. I says, you lose an arm or a leg, I says, they kill it, but I says, don't let me sight.
Was there much talk amongst yourselves and the men, of course, about what might happen?
No, we never bothered. Never talked about it. And they just says, well, we said we'd, best of all, we'll get through it. I says, we'll all stick together and we'll all get through it, like. And we were cramped in this boat, like. And then eventually we got orders to sail at night time. And that's the worst sea journey I've ever had. Not that I was frightened, like, but, oh, you see, the boat was zigzagging, and it was rough. And it was sick, was coming out of both ends. Because I had got the diarrhea, and, oh, I was seasick. But eventually, by the time we got over there, we got over it. We got used to it. But
were the toilet facilities okay?
No, there was rigs stuck out at the rear of the boat. You had to go there, drop your pants. Everybody was sick over the side. But we're all right, like, we eventually sorted out, and by the time we got round by the Isle of Wight, we didn't know it was the Isle of Wight, because we weren't concerned about it. And then when darkness came, we all went down below deck. We had our life jackets on. And then went on, and then all of a sudden we got orders to prepare to get off the ship, like. So we all, still downstairs, like, and then we got orders, and all of a sudden we heard this bump, and then there was a ramp, and we heard the sailor say, right, that's your lot. And we all went up, and we said, oh, we're not ashore yet, we're still out to sea. Because we're about maybe 100 yards away from the shore. So she says, right, off you go. So we stepped off the run. I stepped up about 5 foot, nearly 6 foot of water. It hit more like a sandbank. He thought he'd hit the shore. And
was this an American or British crew?
It was an American sailor. It was an American crew that was on the boat. So we always trudged ashore, and there was a bit of firing, but not a great lot, because I think the troops in front of us had popped them mostly up. But we saw the damage that the bombers to these gun emplacements and what the big shells from our battleships had done, and they had blown them to bits, and you could see the imprint of some of the men that the blast had caught imprint on the wall side. And we said, Barge, a good job. They would be knocked out. They were definitely knocked out, the guns, before we landed.
But what was the view as you looked into the beach?
It was a plain beach.
Was there a lot of wreckage, bodies?
No, there's no bodies, nothing. It must have been cleaned up. But we never noticed any. To tell the truth, my mind was a blank. All my mind was that I wanted to get onto dry land.
What time was this?
It was about 8 o'clock, I think, when we landed. 8 o'clock in the morning.
Can I just ask you this point? What were you carrying with you when you
landed? I was carrying my full pack. I was wearing a bicycle with a paint gun on it. And Geordie Spatter, he was carrying the bombs. He had six bombs. He was weighing them down.
What rations had you been given?
Well, we'd been given, well, before we'd left, we'd been given a tin of bully, and, wait a minute now, we had American K rations, that was it. We got a pack issued, a very small pack, and there was 5 cigarettes, and I've never seen them since. There was a can of soup, and you should light a fuse. You had to puncture it. And you had to light a fuse, and within about 5 seconds, it was boiling soup. Also, there was tins of cocoa, and there was no tea. And there was no soft drinks, But biscuits were very good, and that. And there was dried meat. You had to soften it, put dip your water on it. And yes, there was a couple of cans of water with a fuse in, and we could dip this warm, and it dissolves, right? It made the like a mince. It was quite good and all, but we never saw them anymore, because when we that was Landers keep us going. I think it was he said that was a 2-day ration you could get. We had, I said, 5 cigarettes.
In addition to showing you where you would be landing, or talking about where you would be landing, had they given you any idea of how they expected you to go for the first day or two, or where?
Well, see, we just had to follow the duty, the rifle companies. See, and first of all, I think they were in touch with radio and runner till they got really established. But they nearly really got established till nearly the about the sixth or seventh year with the lines. Then we got lines out, and no sooner we got the lines out, to some of them were moved again, and then we bypassed Bayeux.
This initial phase, you would all come together at some point. I think you said.
Yes,
it was
we all. There's an assembly point.
And was there any problems in that?
No, there's no. Everybody there was nobody lost, and we had no casualties. Then the signal, what was signal was, because there was two signals with each company, you know, there's two signals with them. And there was no casualties with them.
And who was commanding your A Company, by the way?
I don't know. That A Company in 9th, but I was with the signal platoon. I don't know the A Company because I never met the CO. And
was there any shelling going on?
There was odd shells dropped, and could hear machine gun fire in the distance, and you could hear one or two of the bullets clipping over the top of you. But that wasn't much till we, and then till the night time, and then we got all assembly in the wood, and we were preparing. It says now, then they said we'll stand from dawn, from daylight, twilight. They said we'll stand two for an hour, and at the vantage we stood two for 4 hours, because somehow or other the rifle companies had bypassed. A jury patrol, a platoon or something, and they started firing at night time. But eventually.
This was the first night. The
first night. And it was like in a small wood. And we all had to take cover. Well, the first thing we did was dig a flat trench. So the.
Had you had any opportunity to see any French civilians at this stage?
No. And no civilians at all. We never saw, because we bypassed Bayeux. And then next morning, we were pinned down there, I think, for about a day, till they mopped this jury patrol, I think. I didn't know it was a patrol or a platoon, but I think somehow they got bypassed. So the.
Had you been doing anything up to now?
No, we hadn't. We'd just been defending company Battalion HQ.
You still had your cycle and your paired gun?
Yes, I still had my cycle and a paired gun. And eventually I got taken off it. I don't know who got it, but this is right over. This is when we got established, well established, after about the 10th day. And that came when we set off to march, and we came across a farm, came up to this main road, and. Where was it? I think it was between Bayeux and Tillis or Souls. And it's quite a nice day. And this farmer put him up with, a great big can of milk. So I said, we'll have a drink of milk now. And that's when they start the thrashes. We start getting meals, more like soups and everything brought up to us.
What kind of countryside were you fighting through?
Vegetation, just like an English countryside. And then we moved, kept moving up, and we could hear the skirmishes going up in the front, like. And then we eventually got established there, everybody's formed up, and we got some lines out to the companies, just short lines they were. And that's all I can remember about till.
Were you under fire while you were doing this, or was it pretty quiet?
It's pretty quiet. And then.
Had you seen any Germans at all?
Just wounded Germans and prisoners that had been sent back. What they were doing, see, they weren't escorting them back, they were just disarming and saying, get back behind the lines.
Were they good calibre German troops?
I don't know.
Didn't get no opportunity to speak to
Well, no, we never had opportunity to speak to him. There was one or two wounded by the side of the road, like, but we just walked straight back, because you said the stretcher bearers and that would pick them up and dress them.
Were the Germans booby-trapping the area at all?
Not for the time being. After we got further on, places were getting booby-trapped.